Welcome back to the Anarcho Book Club. So I'm going to start today with a couple of updates. The first is that I have updated the website. I'll put a link on the website to the resource I used, but I've basically condensed the whole website into a single HTML page and a massive CSS style sheet. And it's from a guy, from a guy named Gregory Kedars, or Caters, on GitHub. And it was a really neat little schema that he put together. I just wanted to try it out, and I really liked it. I tried it out in a test site first, and then decided to port it over. But I will say the mobile, I've uploaded it and everything, and the mobile site doesn't work nearly as well. I'm assuming I've messed up some of the tags or something, and it's not scaling right. So I'm going to go through that. Problem is, the benefit is that whenever you load the site, you're loading the entire page, and you never have to, no matter what link you follow, as long as it's part of the site, you never have to worry about loading it again. The drawback to that is, and I knew this going in, is the code, the HTML on it is pretty, it's big. It's a lot of lines of code. And so if I added an extra div tag or something, or a closing tag, which I think might be what I did, it's very difficult for me to find. I've been looking and looking. I decided to take a break and record this episode real quick. So, and I need to update the CSS because I don't think the media queries are right. But anyway, that's you probably don't want to hear all that. But the other update is, okay, I got the email pulled up. Someone emailed me to mention that in my second or third episode, which I think it was the third episode. Now I've forgotten. I've listened to it, and now I've forgotten which it is. I mention how the government shutting down the economy and everything to combat COVID-19. I say how it's antithetical to anarchism, and he pointed out, they pointed out that while that is technically true, it is helpful. Not only helpful, but it does help to combat the virus, the pandemic. And I do agree with that, and I did not mean to lead anyone to think that they should buck the authority just for the sake of bucking the authority, so to speak. I didn't mean to recommend to anyone to not lockdown, because it does seem like it is, I mean, statistically, at least from what I've seen, it seems like it does help to contain the spread so that people can build herd immunity or just build up immunity, period. So I didn't mean to tell anyone, hey, your government might be telling you you have to stay inside, but you walk out there, you don't wear your mask, and you try and don't protect anyone. That's not what I was trying to say. I just wanted to clear that up. What I was trying to say was, at least, so it was a perspective thing. In my perspective, where I live, if you disobey, simply for the sake of disobeying any order given by the governor or your local officials, you can be thrown in a cage immediately. And there's a part of me deep down that really, really doesn't like that. And really, I think that's immoral. So I guess probably what I was doing was I was fighting against that perspective. Although, that doesn't mean I'm going out. If they tell me I have to quarantine, it doesn't mean I'm going to just walk out and say, screw you, you're the government, I'm not quarantining. That doesn't mean that. It just means that I don't think that it would be moral for them to demand that I do something at the point of a gun. Let's put it that way. So, I hope this isn't making it worse, but I just wanted to mention that I really think that you should do something. You should take preventative measures. You should take the measures. Use the hand sanitizer. Whatever it is. Do what you do. And do it of your own free will. So when I say that it's not moral for the government, or from my perspective, it is my perspective. I understand that other localities, even within the United States, are not quite as... they're not coming down quite as authoritarian as my own county and my own state, for that matter. So I just kind of wanted to clear that up. So hopefully nobody took my words and ran out in the streets coughing on people. I don't think you did. I think most people are probably smart enough not to act impulsively like that. But, well, you know, we'll see. So, all right. So now that that's cleared up, let us, hopefully it's cleared up, let us continue on to the topic of the day. Let me switch over here. We are going to be talking about The Conquest of Bread by Peter Kropotkin. And I looked into, there's entire websites devoted to this book. In fact, let me switch over to that real quick. There's one called thebreadbook.org. Very useful resource. Love this website. I've only looked at it for a few minutes, but already I can tell you that I'm really, really a fan of this website. They have, not only do they have the book, you click on The Conquest of Bread, you can get the audiobook, EPUB, or PDF. And I'll put this link on the website, but, or the link to this. But if you're just listening and you want to look it up while you're listening, it is just thebreadbook.org. That's it. Easy. And but then they have a section, Community Resources, here. And they have a bunch of different organizations that you can look into, including one that I am a member of, actually, and I donate to regularly. It's the Rise Up Tech Collective, and which I recommend you go look at, especially if, like, say you're using Gmail for your primary email. Rise Up offers free email accounts. I mean, it's free. It's recommended that you donate, but you can use it for free. They also have a free VPN, and they have a chat server, XMPP server, or Jabber server, whatever you call it. It's pretty neat. So, and I've been using it for probably 6 or 8 years, something like that. It's been a long time since I started my account with them, and really love the stuff they do. They also have these, something that surprised me, actually, the Socialist Rifle Association. And they bill it as an educational organization dedicated to providing the working class with the information they need to be effectively armed for self and community defense. This includes all manner of community defense, from the right of the working class to possess firearms to the ability to be well versed in the fields of medicine, disaster relief, logistics, agriculture, and survival skills, which I will check that out too eventually, but and a number of others. But it's a really interesting website. I'm a big fan. Then they've also got Spread the Bread, which you can download their logo stickers. Yeah, so you can print them out, make stickers, or you can put them on your website. You can do whatever you want. Anyway, so it's a cool website and interesting resources there. There's a few others. There's, I was reading, of all places, I don't really get on Reddit that much, but I was reading on Reddit what people think of The Conquest of Bread. I personally, after I read this book, I thought it was probably one of the best, at least, well, the best introductions to anarchism that there is. I wish I had read this book years and years ago, whenever I first became interested in the anarchist movements, all the different anarchist movements. But on Reddit, they, even now, there was a post, someone said, was it relevant anymore? And you should have seen all the posts. It was, people jumped on it. I think people might agree with me, in the white, at least on Reddit, that it is a very, very relevant book. I did notice a few things while I was reading that they seemed a little bit out of date, but it really doesn't matter. If you're reading it with a critical eye, like I'm trying to read it extremely critically. And if you read it like I was reading it, you might pick up on a few things that may not be quite so relevant as they once were, but it is a minority of things, a minority of points that he makes. In fact, I only remember one or two, and I took notes, and I have my notes this week, so I might go over some of them. So I thought I just wanted to mention this website and mention a few things before we dive into it, but let's dive in now. So chapter one really sucked me in, and I will tell you I'm coming this at from the perspective of a from the perspective of literary criticism. So the first thing I noticed whenever I started reading this book, just the first two paragraphs, he begins with a classical quote-unquote looking back at the glory of nature in the mysteries held within the woods or the forest. And he even says mankind as a single unit is piercing the forests, meaning, and what he was talking about was they're going in and taking the lumber that they need, clearing out the mystery of nature. And but it's a common theme throughout at least all of Western literature that I've read. Shakespeare, the forest was the mysterious, the magical. Going into the forest was going into a new realm. All of medieval literature mentions the forest, and even more ancient literature, well, no, medieval too, they talk about the Great Black Forest, which at one point spread all across Europe. And the mysteries and the magic that was within it. And he talks about how we're piercing into that forest. How we're... Excuse me. I've not had enough coffee this morning. How we are piercing the forest and clearing it for the use of mankind. And for the use of the community. And another thing that really gave me the mindset that he's building a mythological narrative here, and he's setting it all in the mythological. And one point about that, actually, is that he uses round numbers like 10,000 and 100 and 1,000. And this is a classic method of projecting large sums or even... throughout Eastern, Middle Eastern, and Western mythologies, 1,000 always seems, or 10,000 always seems to represent the infinite, or the greatest number possible. And there's something to say about that, because no matter what it is that you're telling, if you're telling a story about something that happened to you, or a story about something that you perceive as truth, you're telling it through your perspective. And this goes back to my update. I was telling the story of government lockdowns through my perspective, and it was a story. And everything we say, everything we do, is all a story. You go to work, say, and you do what you do. Say you sit at a computer and enter data, and then you clock out and you go home. If you go home to anyone that you might tell this story to, you will start and tell them the story of how you went in, you started entering data, and then your coworker made a kerfuffle about something that they were annoyed about, and everything you said to you was true, and it was true. Everything is true that you've just told. But you've told a story. The person that you talked about, their story will be different. And it all builds into a mythology. And the predominant stories become the mythologies that we know. And so Kropotkin's use of where he dives straight into the mythology, the mythos of the story of humanity and the human struggle and the community struggle. The mythos that he creates, that he pulls forward, it's a story, and it is true. It is true to him. And it can be true to us as well if we find truth in it. And I'm not trying to make a case for relative knowledge or relative truth or the relativity of truth. But there is something to be said for perspective. And I'm not saying all of this just to justify my own misspeaking and my own focus on my own perspective. I'm saying this because no matter what mythology you read, it is a perspective on truth. And it is an interpretation of truth. It is an interpretation of events that is true to the person speaking it or writing it. So there is something there to be considered, and I think you, dear listener, should keep that in mind as we go forward. And that's part one. He builds the mythology. Part two of chapter one, he says, he goes into the substance of all socialism, as he says. And it is that that the few restrict the many from gaining the means of production through monopolistic venture. And I can see the truth in that. The truth in the mythos that he's built. And I think we all see the truth in it. He returns to the forest imagery and how it's cleared, how the forest is cleared and the swamps are drained. The rock, and to quote him, the rock walls in the valleys are laid out in terraces and covered with vines bearing golden fruit. I mistyped there. And this is more, this is driving deeper into the mythology of the story that he's telling. Because this is the imagery of the Garden of Hesperides. And I hope I said that right. I don't know if I did. Which, the garden which eventually started the Trojan War. The apple, the golden apple in the Garden of Hesperides is also called the Apple of Discord. It's something that the gods all want. They all long for. It's the golden fruit which gives eternal life. The gods gain their eternal life from this fruit, but it also causes discord. The seeking of eternal life, or in this case, perhaps, eternal treasure. The seeking of monopolies for the great, the power that comes with wealth. The endless wealth, endless growth of the markets. That is the golden apple of discord. Well, then he goes on to paint a picture of struggle and toil. The struggle against it. The struggle against it being the discord caused by the seeking of monopolistic power. And he talks about Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations to show the rise of civilization against the odds, blood, sweat, toil, and death. Although he does disparage Adam Smith a bit, because Adam Smith, he paints another mythology. One that maybe you don't find truth in. Maybe you do. I don't know. I don't actually know who my listener base is, to be honest with you. But Adam Smith's mythology is one of machinery, and each man and woman in the machine, they're all cogs in this machine, and they all have their own jobs, and their jobs work for a single entity. The government or the monopoly. But I repeat myself. And he builds, so he goes on from that to build a narrative of quote-unquote common property, one thing built upon another. And he references how in days of old, even days now, buildings were built upon another. So I remember from my studies in college, I studied the ancient Hebrews and the Greeks. The Hebrews would build a city upon another city. They would go and in the mythology of the Bible, they go, which is another mythology that some people may find truth in. And I think they wouldn't be wrong to. There's a lot of truth in the mythology of the Bible. But they go and say they conquer because they left Egypt. And they wander and wander, and then they conquer Jericho. And upon the ruins of that city, they build their own city. The broken buildings, the broken walls, are the foundation of new walls and new buildings. And we all build on the backs of those who came before us. We build on the structures that were set up before us. And it's a slow evolutionary change in society. Society started long ago with, well, earliest recorded history, you had the city-states. Each city was its own state. And they grew out of small towns and villages of people working together to try not to die of hunger, to try not to die. And they would form cities with walls to defend against the outside, and they worked for a common good. This is the narrative we're told in history. And but likewise, think of the car you may or may not own. Think of the bicycle. These are things that were built upon the labor of those that came before. So long ago was invented the wheel. I can't tell you when because I can't remember. It's been more than a decade since I've studied that. But long ago we had the wheel. I believe it was the Sumerians that are credited with the wheel. And the wheel eventually turned into a wagon. So someone took someone else's invention and took two of those and stuck them on a box and hitched it to, maybe in the beginning they didn't hitch it to an animal. Maybe they pulled it themselves. I don't know. I'm not sure. But they built upon the works of those that came before. Eventually that wheel became something else. It became a four-wheeled wagon. And eventually, it became a steam-drawn wagon, known as a train. And eventually, it became a diesel or petroleum-drawn wagon. And that's what we call a car. Eventually, these things, and from the car, you have an engine that drives the car. And that engine was taken out and put into a plane. And so even the plane is built on the back of the wheel. Everything can be traced back, and everything is built upon one another. And that is where Kropotkin draws his Kropotkin draws when he makes the argument for common property. And this is a narrative that I can buy into a lot better than I could with Proudhon's work about property being theft. And maybe it was because the story he told, the mythology he told, was too much on the nose and it was too difficult to buy into. Kropotkin, he tells a story in a way, he tells the story of common property in a way that I can buy into. I can accept it a little bit easier, Even though common property, the idea of common property does go against my initial upbringing as a child, and throughout my teenage years, and even through my early 20s, the idea, the narrative of common property, it has always been, at least in the West, it has been something to be looked at with disdain. That's the communist. That's the evil red. The red communist, and they want you to join them to destroy the world. That's the devil working underneath to... And whenever you say, this cup is mine, or this cup of coffee is mine, you have to understand there's a lot that goes into that. Whereas Adam Smith might say, yes, that is your property. How do you know that is your property? Well, the government says, or the common law says that is your property. And that is yours. You own it. But in the same way, whenever I sell my services to my company, to the company that I work for, they own those services because they've paid for them. And that doesn't jive well with the narrative that Kropotkin's put forth. And a narrative that I'm very sympathetic to. He'll go on later. We'll get into later the common property. But the end of section note that I put here, he makes the case. And this is him speaking. By what right, then, can anyone whatever appropriate the least morsel of this immense whole and say, this is mine, not yours? And this is a more powerful statement than what Proudhon says in his whole essay. In fact, I think this single statement has more persuasive power, backed up by the narrative that he's built already, the mythology that he's derived already. It is a more powerful statement than Proudhon's entire essay. And I think, well, I appreciate it a lot more. And myth building is a key to understanding. You have to build, like I said earlier, you have to build up the mythology, build up the story. And sure, only use the things that you perceive as true, but understand that is your perception. And that is what I forget sometimes. Sometimes I forget that it is my perception that I am building the myth of my life, or the myth of the stories that I tell. It is your perception, and it is your own mythology that you say, that you speak to others. So let's move on to part three. Let's see. He begins part three by talking about whole bodies of people. Ah, yes, that's right. The miners, the farmers, the population. He speaks like as Marx spoke, as the class of these two classes, the whole body of people. I mentioned that, I put that in my notes because I noticed it was a break from how all of the other anarchists we've studied so far have spoken. I mean, they mention, most of them do mention different classes, the two classes. Konkin mentions the two classes even. But they speak as if they're speaking, they write as if they're speaking to the individual. In part three, he begins, and it does break with the other parts, the other two parts. He begins speaking of, he's speaking to the individual about these bodies of people. But then he does move, he moves on to talk about the individual and his or her lack of rights to a specific machine or property, simply for having, or I'm sorry, I'm just reading my notes now. So he moves on from the whole to the individual, and he talks about the lack of rights to of a person. simply because the owner of the machine, or the person who proclaims ownership of the machine, has invented it, or has come up with it, or has purchased it, without knowing, or without acknowledging, that the knowledge to own this machine, the knowledge to invent this machine, or to purchase this machine, it was given to him or her by the knowledge of his or her predecessors. He then goes on to compare the capitalist model. This is Kropotkin. He goes on to compare the capitalist model to the feudalist model. And he says, in feudal times, a person would give a quarter of their produce to the lord. In capitalist times, that person must work for a wage, which is much less than the product of his labor. And that's true. It is much, much less. In fact, I'm paid on a commission scale. So I earn 1% of the price of each product that I handle. Now, that doesn't mean I only make 1% of the total product, so to speak, the total gain. In fact, I make quite a bit more than that. But, as Kropotkin rightly says here, it is much less than a quarter of that produce. And then, to say, okay, I make 1% of the total price of the product, which I think equals out to something like 4 to 5, maybe 6% of the, depending on the product, of the total profit. But, and then of that, say, let's just be optimistic and say I'm making 6% of the profits. And then we have another monopolist coming in and taking something like 27.3% of those profits away from me. So now I'm making much, much less. I'm not ready to do the mental math right now, but I think it's something a little bit over 4% of the total profits. So, and that monopolist is known as the government, taking 27 and some change percent from me. And they don't even contribute to my life nearly as much as the monopolists that I work for. And he goes on, with that in mind, he goes on to say, wars, perpetual wars, break out for the right of precedence in the market. And this is the government we're speaking of, but it's not just the government, because who do you think drives the wars? The wars that America wages upon all across the earth. We have troops, the United States government has troops stationed all over the globe. All over Europe, they have troops stationed all over Africa. They actively make bombing campaigns all over Africa. And not to mention the Middle East. Active bombing campaigns all across the Middle East, troops stationed, troops shooting all across the Middle East. And in Asia, don't think Asia's untouched by this. The United States has troops stationed in Asia, all over Asia, in fact. The only place they're not allowed is China and Russia. But even that's not untouched. Think of the intelligence agencies stationed all over the globe. So, and they do all of this, and who are they working for? They're working for, say, the President of the United States, different interests. And who are those different interests? Those different interests are the corporations. The corporations that run the United States. And so they all work together. And we, you might call us the proletariat, we're left out of this. We're not part of that game. The only part we play in that game is that we work for them. And so, and he goes into all of that in this book, or in this section of the book. But he also goes on to say, a vast array of courts, judges, executioners, policemen, and jailers are needed to uphold, is needed to uphold these privileges. And this array gives rise in its turn to a whole system of espionage and false witness, of spies, of threats and corruption. We all know that without uprightness, without self-respect, without sympathy and mutual aid, humankind must perish. These are the things that he perceives, and I also perceive. And I think my listeners, my dear listeners, may also perceive in the world today, regardless of the country that you live in. And then he lays out the first principles of this mythology he's building. And I'll read through them right now. The means of production are the collective work of humanity. The product should be the collective property of the race. That is the race of humanity. Individual appropriation is neither just nor serviceable. All belongs to all. All things are for all men, since all men have need of them, since all men have worked in the measure of their strength to produce them, and since it is not possible to evaluate everyone's part in the production of the world's wealth. All things are for all. And he sees... Okay, so he says all of this, and then he critiques what he says is the fee to use some machine as a tax. That fee is a tax. The fee to use the machine to produce is a tax, and it is a tax by the corporation on the laborer. And that is how he ends chapter one. And I'm gonna try not to go through all of the chapters, because it goes through and he talks. Well, let me just the actual chapter titles are interesting, because he goes through and he talks. Chapter one was Our Riches, and you saw there he builds the mythology, and it is the riches that humanity has accumulated over the years, over the millennia even. And then chapter two, he stakes a claim for the well-being for all. Chapter three, he outlines anarchist communism. Chapter four, he covers what he introduced in chapter one of expropriation. Chapter 5 is about food and the accumulation of food and the distribution of food. And he talks about how all bread is for all men. And of course, in his time, he's talking about mankind here. All food, all bread is for all people, all of everyone. Then he talks about dwellings. And that's an interesting chapter. Which we can go into, but I really want to give you an overview. I don't want to walk you through every single stage of it. I don't want to walk you through every chapter. I want you to read it, because I think this is one of the best works I've read so far. I mean, Bakunin is still probably one of my favorites, but Kropotkin, he does a very good job of building this story, the story of the conquest of bread. And he goes through clothing in chapter 3. He goes through the ways and means, meaning how all this is going to work in chapter... let's see. Oh, I said... I don't know. I'm not saying the numbers right. In chapter 8. chapter 9 is The Need for Luxury. I like that chapter. That I do like luxury. Agreeable Work is chapter 10. Chapter 11. Oh, it doesn't have a title. I thought they all had titles. Chapter 12 is Objections. I don't remember what chapter 11 was. Chapter 13 is The Collectivist Wage System, which I highly recommend, especially for my anarcho-capitalist friends out there. Actually, I recommend this whole book for my anarcho-capitalist friends because and my agorist friends because it is very enlightening on the different systems that could be in place. Chapter 14 also is untitled. I did not know that. Chapter 15 is The Division of Labor. And 16 is The Decentralization of Industry, which I think is particularly useful to everyone who I know, because the centralization of power is what holds down what Kropotkin would call the proletariat, and what all of my anarchist friends, most of them, would call the proletariat. And then, oddly enough, he goes, chapter 17 is agriculture. I did find that kind of odd that he ends it with that, but it makes sense, because this is the conquest of bread. And all of these, all of the chapters are really interesting, but I wanted to get into the perspective. I wanted to talk about the mythology that he builds, and he builds it throughout. He doesn't stop in the first chapter, even though we've only just covered the first chapter. He builds he gives his insight through the storytelling of his book. And it is a good insight. It is a historical insight. Whew. Man, I really should have taken a coffee break. I'm really sorry about that. I don't know how other people handle yawning or coughing or sneezing. I've heard of these things called cough buttons, but I don't know anything about that. So I really recommend this book to anyone who hasn't read it. If you have read it, I'd like to know your thoughts on it. And I guess I'm kind of done explaining through the book. I could go more into it, but I don't want to take away from anyone who hasn't finished it or read it yet. It is a great foundation. This is one of the things I wanted to say. And actually, let me bring my notes up because I think I have a list of things I wanted to say about it. There we go. It is a great foundation for any anarchist, this book. And see, here's the other thing. So I've read The Communist Manifesto by Marx years ago, and I read it again last year, just kind of as a refresher. And in comparison, and I think these two are comparable, these two books, this is The Conquest of Bread, in my opinion, is a vastly superior work to The Communist Manifesto. The Communist Manifesto seems to presuppose the existence of a strong central state and centralized power, even though I have a lot of problems with Marx. A lot of his works I just have a lot of problems with, because he assumes so many things. And not to say that Kropotkin doesn't assume things or take for granted certain ideas, but Marx is much more closed-minded in his works, and he doesn't allow for quite as much human individualism. And he doesn't go into the detail that Kropotkin does. And I think that it's time to put down your copy of The Communist Manifesto, put down your copy of Das Kapital, and pick up The Conquest of Bread. Use Marx's works as a foundation, not as a foundation, but use them as something to add to your own collected philosophy and wisdom. But don't use it as a foundation, I don't think. I think it is a... it is not as well polished as this is. And maybe, I mean, you can do whatever you want. We're all anarchists here, right? You can do whatever you want. But I would strongly urge you to consider The Conquest of Bread as a better foundation, as something written by someone who was a statist and who believed in state control. In so much as he did. But that is my little review of The Conquest of Bread. And I'll put all the links to everything in on the website. I haven't quite figured out how to link, because I know HTML and I know CSS. But whenever it comes to putting links in my description of my of the podcast feed, I'm having difficulty. I've tried it many times, and it doesn't show up as a link in the podcatcher that I use. So it just shows up as a bunch of jumbled XML tags that I've... Anyway, so I'll put it on the website, and maybe I'll figure out how to put links in my RSS feed, but or Atom feed, whatever it is. And... we'll go from there. So that has been The Conquest of Bread by Peter Kropotkin. And I hope you guys enjoyed the book. And if you haven't read it yet, please do read it. And please do contact me. Go to my newly restyled website. And in the About page, you can find out how to contact the show. Or me, directly. So thanks for listening. And I hope you all have a wonderful day.